This is an ABC podcast.
Aloha ni, no ia e Māori and good whana morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Now coming up on the show today, a German family become the first successful applicants to its new citizenship by investment program in Nauru. Talks are underway in Geneva to produce a plastics treaty to cut plastic pollution. And shortly we'll be crossing to Fiji on the trial of former PM Bainimarama and ex-police commissioner Sitiveni Giriho. That and more coming up on the show, but I'm your host, Aggie Dubois, and I say kumulatata. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine, who has questioned whether the Micronesian Republic should stay in the Pacific Islands Forum as Solomon Islands considers whether it will restrict attendance of non-members at September's Pacific Islands Forum. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manila has been coming under increasing pressure over whether his country will allow Taiwan's representatives to attend the regional meeting and to defuse a potentially explosive stoush at the key regional meeting. But as Whenau Whanua reports, there's concerns about the spat overshadowing the challenges facing Pacific Island nations.
In a speech at the opening for Marshall Islands 46th Parliament, President Hilda Heine said she believed that non-members should not be allowed to dictate how the Pacific Islands Forum conducts business.
We witnessed at the forum in Tonga how China, a world superpower, interfered to change the language of the forum communique, the communique of our Pacific leaders. This is a practice my government will never tolerate. If the practice of interference in the affairs of the forum becomes the norm, then I question our nation's membership in that organisation.
Her remarks come as Solomon Islands is considering restricting Taiwan and other non-members from attending the regional meeting, as it attempts to defuse a potentially explosive stoush over Taiwan's attendance. Massey University Associate Professor Anna Powles says there's increased pressure from China on countries who have hosted the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting.
We saw this in Cook Islands, notably, as well as in Nuku'alofa and Tonga, when Tonga hosted. And we're seeing it this year with respect to Solomon Islands.
And University of the South Pacific Law academic Sandra Tart says over the years, China has successfully whittled down the allies Taiwan has in the Pacific.
China globally, you know, is recognized as the country that rules China, PRC that is. And there are very few countries left that recognize the ROC in Taiwan. And that's playing out in this region as well. There's a few diehard supporters or allies of Taiwan. Probably hard to know whether that will change in the future. But yes, I mean, China does have a very dominant position.
Those three remaining allies are Marshall Islands, Palau and Tuvalu. Those three nations are part of the Micronesian bloc in the Pacific Islands Forum, a group that's previously split from the forum in 2021 after they lost the vote to elect a new Secretary General, a move that threw the regional body into chaos. Marshall Islands Journal editor Giff Johnson says that now there's a danger of a similar disruption occurring again.
Well, this is the irony, isn't it, that just 3 years after the forum nearly split up over a totally different issue, almost split up into a factionalized situation based on the various sub-regions having issues with each other, but solved that problem and, you know, got back together, that just 3 years later, I mean, that's certainly what President Heine is suggesting in her comments.
Mr. Johnson says the Marshallese government would see the barring of Taiwan from this year's Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting as an attack on its sovereignty, especially when Taiwan is a key development partner.
Taiwan is a major donor partner, and so it's a significant thing for them to be able to talk with Taiwan. Now, the fact of the matter is that Taiwan also contributes to the forum secretariat, independent of the three countries. And she just says, look, you know, we're t- Tuvalu, Palau, we all have the same position, which is there shouldn't be any debate on this since Taiwan has been a foreign development partner since 1993.
But as the region inches closer towards the meeting in September, Anna Powers says the spat between China and Taiwan is a distraction from more important issues.
There is certainly strong concern among many of the officials that I've spoken to in the region that that China has an undue level of influence over the conduct of the leaders' meeting. The leaders' meeting should not be a geopolitical circus. It should not be disrupted by strategic competition and the strategic interests of dialogue partner countries. And this is really reflecting and amplifying existing disunity and fragmentation within the region.
And that's Massey University Associate Professor Anna Powers. Now, the trial of Fiji's former Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, over allegations he used his position to get two policemen fired is underway in the capital, Suva. He's pleaded not guilty to making an unwarranted demand with menace to the then acting police commissioner to terminate two officers in 2021. The police commissioner at the time, Sitiveni Kiliho, is on trial alongside him, charged with abuse of office for sacking the officers. Both men are already serving jail sentences after being found guilty last year of interfering in a police investigation into the University of the South Pacific in 2019. So joining me now is FBC journalist Nicole Kuma, who is covering the trial. With that, I say, Bula Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Bula Vinaka, thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate your time. Do you mind if you could just walk us through the background and, you know, the primary allegations against former Prime Minister Viringa Bainimarama and also ex-police commissioner Sitiveni Kiliho, please?
Yes, of course. So in this case, the former Prime Minister Viringa Bainimarama and former police commissioner Sitiveni Kiliho had made improper demands to the then acting police commissioner Rusiate Tondrafu to terminate two police officers, Sergeant Penyali Rati and Constable Tomasi Naulu. Specifically, it is alleged that Bainimarama, in his capacity as Prime Minister, threatened Tondrafu with resignation if he did not fire those two officers. And it is alleged also that Kiliho, as the Commissioner of Police, later abused his authority as Commissioner of Police by overruling Tundravu's disciplinary decisions and terminating the employment of those two officers in question.
Okay, well then what is the expected duration of the trial? And do we know how many witnesses are anticipated to testify?
Yes, so this trial started yesterday, the 5th of August, and is expected to continue until the 29th of this month. So okay. That's quite a long time. And also, there's 22 witnesses that will be called in this matter.
Mm. Do you know what were some of the key witness testimonies that emerged on day one, though?
So on day one, there were about four individuals that took the stand to give evidence. So the first witness was actually the former defense minister and the current opposition leader of parliament, Inia Seri Ratu. So he did give compelling evidence and testimony. And I believe there's also the deputy director of the human resource management of the Fiji Police Force and the director of registry at the police force, and also a former police prosecutor who undertook the disciplinary proceedings, or rather who presided over the disciplinary hearing of the two officers who were terminated.
Nicole, you know that this is it's quite a rare case, right, in Fiji, where former top-ranking officials, especially including a long-serving former prime minister, are being tried for alleged abuse of office. I mean, how significant is this case for Fiji?
I would say this is very significant because it involves high-ranking public officials and political figures as well, and they also have some other cases. They were also tried and convicted for another case for which they're serving time for. So this is actually quite significant. First for Fiji, or maybe a very significant case, because there's a lot of eyes on this case, and also this can also be a turning point in Fiji's systems as well. And also, this can set the tone for the future as well, that individuals who hold public office are not immune from scrutiny and from the law. So yes, this is very significant for Fiji.
Wow. Well, what's been the public reaction then to the trial so far?
So far, the public reaction has been very fair. A lot of people are actually turning to our pages and other medias as well and seeing the updates on what is happening and what are the developments that took place on day one. So I would say public reaction has been very positive and very fair at this moment. And as we continue today and throughout this week, I think it is expected to grow.
All right. Well, Nico, look, thank you very much for keeping us across the trial and what is happening. I'm sure once we know the results, we will be in touch with you again. But appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Vinaka.
Vinaka. That is FBC journalist Nicole Kuma speaking to me there from Fiji. Pacific Beat. Malo Lele and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Nauru has approved the first successful applicants to its new citizenship by investment program, a German family concerned by the potential for greater conflict in Eastern Europe. Announced late last year, the aim is to raise $60 million a year to fund climate change adaptation projects and sustainable development in the tiny isolated nation. The CEO of Nauru's Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program, Edward Clark, says all the German family paid around $250,000, of which $140,000 will go to resilience projects.
It's a German family of four who had, I would say, quite a relatively well-known German family. They had a long-standing family business in Germany. They sold it recently and had recently relocated to Dubai. For them, in terms of wanting to apply for Nauru citizenship, it was twofold. So our understanding is that, you know, they're concerned about some of the volatility, particularly in Eastern Europe, and the impacts that they might have on them as a family, particularly as their two younger children are still residing in Germany. And so they were looking for a secondary citizenship just as a backup plan if, for example, Germany were to implement military conscription. The reason that they wanted to move forward with the Nauru program, because there are many programs in the market, is primarily because of the use of the funds by the Nauru government and the fact that the funds raised through the Nauru Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program are going towards funding the climate resilience and economic resilience on the island. They liked the purpose of the citizenship program and so decided to move forward with the Nauru program because of that.
So these are the first people that have been approved. Can you say if you've received other interest?
So, look, we are a new program, so we're working to build credibility and awareness in the market. We did receive these first applications in February, and since then we've received many more. And we're starting to build momentum and build interest and work through the existing pipeline of applications. So currently we're sitting on around 20 applications, and we have many others that we know are coming in the pipeline.
Citizenship by investment programs have received a bit of bad press, particularly in the Pacific, particularly with regards to Vanuatu getting blocked by the EU. What processes are you going through, is the program going through, to avoid situations like that?
The due diligence process is very much at the heart of the Nauru Citizenship by Investment Program. And this is important, as you mentioned, to uphold and maintain the reputation for the country. So I very much view our office's purpose as maintaining or upholding the reputation of the country and maintaining the integrity of the Nauru passport. So in terms of the due diligence process, we conduct in-depth due diligence on each of the applicants applying. This involves, you know, your standard sort of bank due diligence, such as looking at any terrorist or sanction screening watch list. But this is very basic. We also do in-depth negative news screening and social media screening on the applicant. And we do all of these checks before we even accept an application into the program office. Once an application has been accepted, then we go through another two phases of due diligence. The first phase is sharing the information with the Financial Intelligence Unit and the Nauru Police Force, who will do their checks through their own networks on the applicants to identify any potential adverse findings. And then we also work with a number of third-party due diligence providers who conduct discrete background checks on the applicants. So they will go and do background checks to verify information such as their employment, is the source of funds, the source of wealth that they have declared legitimate, really are the main questions that we're trying to identify. They also do checks to verify the authenticity of documents that have been provided to ensure that they are, in fact, legitimate.
For actual Nauruan citizens who are watching this and have seen the commitment made that the money raised by this will be used for sustainable development and climate change adaptation, how can they see that this money is being put towards those aims?
At the moment, the funds that are raised do go through to the Nauru Treasury account. Now, Nauru government operates quite transparent reporting on their government budget and use of government funds. Now, because the program is at an early stage, the funds will just be, you know, commingled into the government accounts and will be reported on through that mechanism. However, we are in discussions with the Nauru government to set up, I would say, a framework to make sure that those funds are allocated towards specific projects or initiatives if the program starts to generate revenue that is over a certain threshold. At the moment, the threshold that we have agreed is around 10 million Australian dollars. And as you mentioned earlier, we have a target of around 60 million per annum. So I'm hoping that we will comfortably achieve that and we can put that mechanism in place. Two other things that I'd like to mention. We do have a ring-fenced account at the moment for the receipt of the funds. But as I mentioned, ultimately those funds will get commingled into the government treasury accounts. The second part is that as a program office, we have an annual reporting requirement and we will report on how those funds are used to the best of our ability. Now, at the current point in time, that will really just be a reflection of how the government are allocating their funds through the government accounts. But once we get to a point where we put that framework in place, we will be able to put some report, I guess, more specifically on how those funds are being used.
And that's the CEO of Nauru's Economic and Climate Resilience Citizenship Program, Edward Clark, speaking to Liam Fox. Now stay tuned because your news wrap is up shortly.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Hold the front page!
Fatsano Fatsun, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, it is your news wrap time, brought to you by our producer, Kyle Evans. How you doing, sir?
I'm well, Aggie. Yeah, it's not Friday yet.
The mood in the studio. Sorry, I've dimmed the lights quite low.
I was just thinking it's actually quite nice in here. It's just like it's a real sort of, you know, sort of mellow morning sleeping kind of
absolutely.
Vibe.
Thank you so much. Look, we've got a couple of stories to share with our listeners this morning. This one here, Pacific families visiting the US may have to fork out thousands of dollars as part of their tourist visas. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right. So the US could require bonds of up to $15,000 under a new pilot program implemented to crack down on visitors who they feel might overstay their visas, Reuters is reporting. So according to the report, the program will give US consular officers discretion to impose bonds on visitors from countries with high rates of visa overstayers. The bonds could be applied to people coming from countries where, say, screening and vetting information is deemed insufficient. And the program will kick in on August 20 and will last for approximately a year. And they reckon the bonds will range between $5,000, $10,000 and $15,000, wow, but will generally be expected to average out at around the 10K mark.
Well, August 20th is very close. That is just around the corner. But do we know what countries will be affected?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. A State Department spokesperson said countries will be identified based on their overstay rates, as well as screening, vetting deficiencies and foreign policy considerations. They didn't list any countries specifically, but we do know in recent months specific nations like Tonga and Vanuatu have found themselves on proposed travel ban lists. That being said, the US Travel Association isn't too concerned. They only estimate that around 2,000 applicants will be affected. So, okay. I mean, that's good news, I guess. Okay. Not obviously not for those poor 2,000 people.
No, yeah, but look, we'll keep our eyes and ears on that story as it develops. Now, this one's really interesting. A staple food item in many Pacific households has actually been removed from supermarket shelves in New Zealand. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right. So corned beef, a staple in many Pacific households, is being placed behind counters in Auckland due to a rise in thefts. So that's according to RNZ, who say the move has come at the frustration of many Pacific shoppers who rely on it to feed big families as an affordable weeknight meal.
Yeah, look, this I have heard of this before. I'm interested to know, has Woolworths themselves actually addressed the move?
They have, in a typical Woolworths way. It's obviously not the first time that they've made headlines in recent months. But they've said it's part of a number of initiatives to reduce retail crime, such as, they've also gone about trolley locking and push talk radios. Mm. The trolley locking, I feel like, always affects me. I never own one of those, sort of little
pins
plastic
that people
white
fit, yes.
Pins, yeah. And if I do, I don't own it for very long. I always end up losing it.
That's it.
So, yeah, I'm always reduced to just, the amount of Woolies shopping bags I've got in my pantry. It's just unbelievable.
You and me both.
I always forget to take them when I go out. They've also reassured shoppers that there's still plenty of supply of corned beef behind the counters. But that hasn't stopped people from feeling, a certain type of way about it. A lot of the people RNZ spoke to, felt quite targeted. One person they quoted even called the move racist. So, yeah, people are certainly unhappy.
Very unhappy, and I have seen that happen. I've actually gone shopping back home and seen it behind a locked cabinet. So unless you, you have to go to the front and say to them, "Hey, I'd like to buy one," and then obviously you need to make sure that you're actually going to buy it. It's a little bit daunting for. Yeah,
given like flask status at a tobacco store or something. Yeah, that doesn't seem right.
I know. But that is an interesting story. Okay, now we head to Vanuatu because I believe there's a cover shortage in Vanuatu. Is that right?
That's right. So in Luganville specifically, the country's second biggest city, kava bars are experiencing an ongoing shortage of fresh kava to meet demand for drinkers. And that's despite being located in a region known for producing some of Vanuatu's largest kava harvests. Mm-hmm. However, the flow of kava has been reducing since June, with prices spiking from about 500 vatu per kilogram to 800 vatu per kilogram. And it's forced some bars to actually have to close on certain nights of the week. Just to keep the head above water.
Okay, well, what's the reason then for the shortage?
So it doesn't seem to be a clear answer. Industry stakeholders agree that the decline of supply is due to reduced kava production, hence the rise in prices. There's talk some farmers are sending their supply to Port Vila where they can get a better price for their harvest. Labour mobility schemes have been a contributing factor, according to the Minister of Agriculture. They just don't have the workforce to be able to harvest them at the same rate. Either way, supply is down. One vendor was actually quoted as saying he's never seen the scarcity to this extent.
Wow.
And locals are now calling for price caps as it's really starting to impact people's livelihoods. Goodness. And quality of life.
I have to ask, though, you were in Vanuatu recently. Did you get Did you taste the kava? Because I did. It's quite strong.
I did, very strong. Yeah, I don't have a high tolerance for it, I've got to say. It didn't take me much to to feel a certain type of way. But that being said, I really did enjoy it, I've got to say. I had a great time. My wife, on the other hand, though, she drank as much as me and felt nothing. So there you go.
Good to know. Hey, Kyle, look, it is always great for you to bring us our news headlines from around the region with our news rep here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, there are high-level talks underway in Geneva to produce an international legally binding treaty on plastic pollution. December talks in South Korea collapsed after a small number of fossil fuel-producing nations blocked attempts by 100 countries to introduce a legally binding treaty that limits plastics production. Health experts have urged the United Nations to take a stronger stance against plastic pollution, which they describe as a grave danger to human health. Now, representatives from 170 countries are hoping to finalise this treaty that would seek to cut plastic pollution by 75% in the next 15 years. So joining me now from Geneva is Andreas Volentras, the project manager of the Pacific Ocean Litter Project, who is part of these talks. Andreas, thank you for making the time.
You're welcome. Good morning in Melbourne.
Yeah, I appreciate your time there. I know it's a little bit late, but look, I know you've finished the first day of negotiations. Can I ask, what did today look like for you?
Thank you. Well, it was the opening day, so we had, after the opening formalities and the pleasantries, we were told that there were 185 countries being represented, registered, 3,500 delegates and 620 observers. So we then moved in the afternoon onto views from the various groupings on the chairman's text that he issued in December 2024. I think at the end of the day, listening to the different views, we can see that there is still a very, very wide gap between the high ambition, low ambition countries. And so day one out of 10 days, we have a lot of work to do to conclude a plastic treaty.
And this is the thing. This is the sixth round of talks, right, to be held over a possible plastics treaty. And I understand there are key points, but what are the key sticking points, though, that delegates can't agree on?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Well, there is just a very fundamental dichotomy or divide between those who think that we should be looking at a treaty that covers the full life cycle of plastics from extraction right through to remediation or disposal versus those other countries that think, no, this is a plastic pollution treaty. Just look at plastics from when it becomes waste. And that is a fundamental issue that has not been resolved, you know, in the past five negotiation sessions. Secondly, to fund the plastic pollution, especially in the marine environment, the remediation is going to cost a whole lot of money. So I think, in this day and age, I think the emphasis is on security, geopolitics, security, and less money going into things like cleanups of plastics because there's no return on investment, right? You're just spending money. So that's another issue. And then finally, it's like there's countries that think there should be global targets and global action and global lists versus those that say, no, it should be nationally based. Leave us alone. We can do it without, a global policeman looking after us. Yeah.
Well, once a treaty does get decided on, how do you think that treaty will ensure accountability and, even enforcement among signatory nations, particularly major plastic producers?
Yes, look, this is a $1 million question. There are certain countries here that have made it very clear that, they're not going to cut their production. So there's an Article 6 on supply, which looks at production and supply, sustainable production and supply. They say, no, that's not even on the cards. So when you talk about accountability and enforcement, I think you're assuming that that there is some sort of agreement to cut back on production. But the answer to that at the global level would be to have traceability, transparency provision, so that you can see that if countries do take action nationally, because you can't address their production, that you know, you can see that they're developed, the design is sustainable, and you can see what they're doing to reduce their production at the national level.
Yeah. Andreas, I know it's only been day one, but are those countries, the major plastic producers, were you aware of some who have still have the same stance, or have some changed?
No, if anything, they've become even more entrenched in their stance. Look, there's a lot of goodwill by certain countries, including the Pacific Island countries, to listen and to, you know, propose bridging proposals to try to reach, to bridge the gap, the divergence. But, some countries have made it very clear that, you know, they don't understand why we keep raising this thing about production and the full life cycle when it's very clear to them, you know, it begins when plastic becomes waste.
Yeah, and of course for our Pacific nations, you know, they are among the worst affected by marine plastic. I'm wondering how their voices being heard, or are they being heard in these negotiations?
Oh, very clearly. You know, I mean, just to the point, just wanted to, you know, inform your audience that it's a huge issue for the Pacific Islands, because we're only responsible for 1.3% of the marine litter that flows into the ocean from the tributaries around us. And so we need a global agreement with, you know, those main polluters doing their part. But we've been engaged not only as AOSIS, which is the Alliance of Small Island States, which includes the Caribbean, Mediterranean, Indian Ocean countries, plus Cuba and Singapore. So there's 39, and we come together as a bloc, sort of highlight SIDS issues, Small Island Developing States issues. Then there's the Pacific Regional Bloc, the Pacific SIDS. And then if there's, you know, no agreed position and countries want to speak in their individual right, then they do so as independent nations. But we've been preparing for this, you know, thanks to the government of Australia, through the project that I manage, to send representatives to these conferences to prepare them. So, no, the Pacific has really been heard loud and clear.
Okay.
In all the negotiations.
Yeah, and that's good to hear. Well, then, what role will financial or technical support play, you know, for developing nations, especially, again, our Pacific Island countries, to try and meet those treaty obligations?
Yeah, well, assuming there is a treaty, and, you know, let's hope that there is, come August the 14th, when the session ends, we will need a lot of money for remediation of the pollution in our marine environment, not only in our EEZs, but in areas beyond national jurisdiction. Probably heard of those gigantic gyres in the Pacific Ocean. Not only that, you know, we'll need assistance with research, development, technology, you know, for cleanups. And also, I mean, across the countries, border control, you know, trade. Very hard for us to detect single-use plastics that are coming in that we might want to get rid of, and hazardous chemicals. We just don't have that capacity. So we'll need a whole lot of assistance for that. Yeah.
Talking about that, I just want to quickly clarify, how are health risks then from, you know, from plastics such as microplastics, toxic additives being incorporated into the treaty's framework?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, because on one hand, you have a group of countries that say definitely, you know, you need to include an article on health, because, you know, it's known that every organ of the human body has some sort of nano or microplastic in it. So, you know, countries like Brazil have a dedicated article they're proposing on health, supported by Pacific Island countries. But then there's others that say, no, this is not an issue that should be covered under the scope of this treaty. You should defer to the World Health Organization and don't touch health in this agreement. So there's no guarantees. And that's what the next 2 weeks will be about. Yeah. But yet there are references to health in the preamble and certain articles. Yeah.
Okay. Andreas, as we wrap up, you know, if agreement is reached, right, like what would be the timeline for countries to really implement the first set of legally binding commitments?
Yeah, well, this depends on the entry into force provision in the agreement. So right now, 90 or 120 days after the deposit of the instrument of ratification of the 50th instrument of ratification by states, it might come into force. I think, but that's legalistic jargon. The point is, once you sign, you then need to have implementing legislation in Australia and common law countries like the Pacific to you know, implement your commitment as you ratify the treaty. And it's going to take time, right? Probably 2-3 years before we can sort of like see traction. Yeah.
Look, we just want to say thank you so much for your time, Andreas. Really appreciate you coming on the show and keeping us across what is happening currently in Geneva. And as you say, August 14th, hopefully we will have a result.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the time, Aggie. Thank you.
No worries. That is Project Manager of the Pacific Ocean Litter Project, Andreas Valentros, here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nesia Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nesia Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello, Lingitha Wantog, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. To the arts now, where the underground music scene in Papua New Guinea has unearthed many talented artists. However, it's also been a hotbed for gender discrimination songs. Now, PNG's censorship office has embarked on a grassroots campaign to stamp discriminatory music out of the industry. But as Carl Evans reports, artists fear it's a move that could stifle artistic freedoms.
When it comes to saying it like it is, anything goes in Papua New Guinea's underground music scene.
In the underground, like, you know, that's not really regulated. Being a hip-hop artist, you know, people, they express themselves. Some just go straight up like gangsta, straight up, you know, really rebel music.
But even famed PNG rapper Sprigga Mech admits sometimes the lyrics can go too far, and particularly in relation to gender.
I come from a two-parent home. I respect our women, so, but, you know, it depends on the upbringing of the artist, too. You know, some came up from broken home, so they'll always carry the grudge of not having a father or not having a mother. That, you know, that's how it comes out.
Gender discrimination, along with other indecent material such as violence, blasphemy and drug promotion, has been rising in the PNG music industry in recent years and spreading online. So much so that the censorship office has launched a campaign to try and stamp it out.
Over time, the music industry in Papua New Guinea has produced some lyrics that are considered inappropriate for general public consumption.
Jim Abani is PNG's chief censor.
The office has received complaints from the public that we are now categorizing as indecent and promote of adultery, prostitution, sex, and other forms of discriminatory songs. The women, particularly the women, have seen that it's a lot of bias and discrimination. The lyrics contain some sexual connotations and references, and also, you know, women are described as an object.
In response, the censorship office is rolling out a series of forums across 12 PNG provinces. They're bringing together experienced musicians, producers, media and government representatives in hopes of establishing appropriate standards to guide artists with their content. It's part of a wider government plan to make PNG culturally and spiritually healthier by 2025.
Up and coming young musicians, we are trying to say that now you come and listen, and at the same time, you tell us. We are gauging views from them. We are going to set the guidelines for you people to follow. It's about decency. We want to promote decency and respect.
Artists such as former Pacific Break winner Danielle are largely on board with the move, but she says it must be done carefully to avoid stifling creativity.
Right now, where the country sits socially, I understand. I mean, obviously, they recognize how much influence music does have on the general population, which is great. I mean, it's great to have an authoritative body recognize the power of music, which is amazing. But in terms of limiting creativity, I mean, I'm hoping that it's not something that, you know, they're going, you have to stick with these guidelines or else, because it's very limiting to someone who, you know, let's say someone who raps.
Sprigger Mech agrees, saying hip-hop music is rebellious by nature, but he concedes that even rappers have to be conscious of how their music can be interpreted.
Some people take it literally. Some they can take it on as like, you know, oh yeah, this is what's happening in the world, and they try to build on that and be positive about it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is music, it is influence, so it's crazy, tricky spectrum, so to say, between the artist in the underground and then the consumer of music, how they take it, you know what I mean? That's where we have to try to draw a fine line, like saying, even though we're underground or mainstream, we're still human beings. We still have to be cautious and responsible of what we say because we influence.
Georgie Ravulo is a professor and chair of social work and policy studies at the University of Sydney. He says there's no evidence to suggest there's a connection between lyrics and antisocial behaviour, but he says the initiative still has merit, as it provides scope for critical conversations around issues like family violence and gender discrimination.
We also need to ensure that music is seen as a tool to create scope for people to express their lived experience. However, it's important to note that if we are hearing these lived experiences of trauma and neglect and abuse, what are we then doing as a wider society to support people to work through and deal with those areas of neglect, trauma and abuse? So I think for me, that's the key here. If we're listening to these particular expressions from music, how do we then go the next step and then create social systems, structures and services that help to mitigate any of those risks in the future?
Danielle, meanwhile, hopes the forum will ultimately be a step towards establishing a mainstream music business in PNG, but a wide range of artists have to be involved in that process.
Hopefully, someday soon, we can establish a proper industry in Papua New Guinea, because right now it's like, you know, they probably heard a few songs or had some complaints and then have decided, oh, no, we're going to stop this, but without the other side as well.
And that's former Pacific Break winning PNG artist Danielle, ending that report by Carl Evans. To sport now, where a year ago, Samoan cricketer Darius Visser broke a world record by scoring 39 runs off a single over in a T20 qualifier against Vanuatu. And then, just last month in Singapore, he became the first player to score a T20 century on consecutive days, first against Hong Kong, then Malaysia, in the Asia-Pacific Champions Trophy. Next up for Samoa is the final T20 World Cup qualifying round in Oman in October, where they'll be up against the host nation and the top side in the Pacific, Papua New Guinea. Rumours are flying that Darius could be playing alongside former New Zealand captain Ross Taylor, whose mother is Samoan. But whether Taylor is there or not, Samoa will be hoping for more fireworks from their record-breaking batter. Although, as you'll hear, Darius Visser is very modest about his achievements.
That's whacked away. That will be going into the gap. And that will be 100 for Darius Visser. He gets there in style, back-to-back hundreds here, and he raises his bat. A brilliant innings. What an entertainer.
I was thrilled with my performances in the end. I started off a little bit slow. The more I got used to that wicket, I've never played on a wicket like that before. It was Pakistan's soil that had just been watered and rolled. So there's no grass on it at all, nothing like what I've ever played in Sydney. It was nice and bouncy. It took me a little bit to get used to, but once I got used to it, it was nice to play on. But yeah, our team, there's a lot for us to take away from that week of cricket. I know we didn't win any games, but considering we're ranked 70th in the world, we took all three teams down to the last over or so, and we remain competitive. So yeah, massive takeaways for us.
So where do you go from here in terms of preparing for the World T20 qualifier to come in October? Will there be any more matches, first of all, for the team between now and then?
Our team will get better. We've got a few guys that are coming in. We've got a few big announcements of guys who are going to include themselves in our team, which I can't say until they make that publicly available. But we'll go to Oman fairly early. We'll go to Oman around the 23rd of September. That gives us about a week to acclimatise and train. I believe we have two trial games before the qualifier, but we're just trying to regroup and train as hard as we can.
You say some big names coming through. But in terms of what this might mean for Samoa competing against initially Oman and Papua New Guinea in the World T20 qualifier, it can only be a boost to morale. I mean, I guess a little disappointing perhaps some of the players who might miss out, but in the end, you've got to put together the best side that can go out and win the thing.
Absolutely. I think there's more than just the World Cup on offer. I know that the Olympics are on offer as well. I believe from what I've been told, the top-ranked team from each region will go through to the Olympics. So for us, we'll be competing against four other teams, four other nations. So we're going to try and chase Papua New Guinea down.
It could be a good time, though, couldn't it, to be taking on Papua New Guinea? There's been so much upheaval in that part of the cricketing world of late, and I suspect the team that takes to the field against you in October will be very different from the team that they put out when they last played. A number of their players have basically turned their back on cricket, PNG.
I guess it's the trouble with associate cricket. Yeah, I've heard not only them, but a couple other nations are struggling with that, but we're trying not to think too hard about it and trying to make sure that every team we play against, we put our best foot forward.
But the way the competition is laid out in this World T20 qualifier coming up, you play against Oman, you play against Papua New Guinea in a group of three, and the top two go through to the next stage. If you make it there, the maths tells me you've got a 50-50 chance of qualifying for the World T20 Cup. So perhaps the hard part is that first bit. If you can get past either Oman or Papua New Guinea, you'd give yourself a genuine chance.
Absolutely. It's pretty cutthroat, isn't it? Just play two games and that could be us all over. So that's why that pre-tournament training block is critical for us to make sure that we perform our best for those two games, and that buys us another six games.
Tell me a little bit about your journey to the Samoan team, because I think you're around 29 now. I mean, could you have played for them earlier, or were you not aware that you could play for them? Did they not approach you? What's the story?
I did have my passport fairly early, and I was in contact with Samoa a little bit earlier than when I did debut. Maybe 2018, 19, I was in touch with them. Unfortunately, that period of time in my life, I was just so busy, and I had work commitments, and it was really hard to get away from work. So I'd known about the Samoan cricket, and I was really, really keen to get involved, but unfortunately, it just took me this long to finally commit.
You've clearly taken to it, because of course, not only have you recently achieved back-to-back hundreds, and you also hold the world record for runs in one over in a T20 international.
Is it history? Is it history? You bet it's history! Six sixes in the over, 39 off it. Unprecedented scenes in up out. Darius Fisa take a bow. 39 runs off the over.
What do you remember of that particular day? An extraordinary performance, and of course, suddenly your name was making headlines all around the world.
I don't remember too much about any of my hundreds. We were sitting around having a beer last week, and the boys were asking me, and I don't remember too much about all three of my hundreds that I scored. The only thing I remember specifically from that Vanuatu game was coming off the field and Daniel Beswick running over to me. He works for the ICC, telling me, like, do you know what's going on? Do you know what you've done? And then he mentioned it, and I had to just regroup and run on the field and start warming up. So it's a pretty quick turnaround. So the only time it really sort of sunk in for me was probably that evening when we sat around and our coach Taryn highlighted what had happened.
The fact that there were these headlines appearing, as I say, literally all around the world. Did you read any of those headlines?
Yeah, I think my parents and friends were a lot more thrilled for me than I was. I just tried to downplay it and move on with my life. I said no to a lot of interviews from the BBC and whatever, because I just wanted to move on and just continue with my life.
One thing clearly your performances have done is put the name of the team out there and what Samoan cricket as a whole is doing. They've had other successes, of course, in the women's game as well. Do you get the sense that cricket is really on the up in Samoa, and that they are catching up with the likes of Vanuatu and obviously Papua New Guinea, who've been the dominant force in the Pacific for so long?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my time spent in Samoa, I realised how big cricket is in Samoa. It was so good to see so many people come out and support us and take interest in the team, not only in Samoa, but in New Zealand and Australia as well. So I think what I've seen over the last week and a half is the support from Samoans, who I don't know anything about. We've been watching our games, streaming our games, and supporting the team as a whole. So I hope that whatever success we have over the next 12 months brings a lot of cricketers who are Samoan out of the ranks in New Zealand, Australia, and Samoa to follow cricket.
And that's Samoa's record-breaking batter Darius Visser with an eye on the World T20 Cup Finals and the LA Olympics. He was talking to Richard Ewart. Recapping our top story with Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine questioning whether the Micronesian Republic should stay in the Pacific Islands Forum as Solomon Islands considers whether it will restrict attendance of non-members at September's Pacific Island Forum.
We saw this in Cook Islands, notably, as well as in Nuku'alofa and Tonga, when Tonga hosted. And we're seeing it this year with respect to Solomon Islands.
And that's Massey University Associate Professor Anna Poles speaking there. Well, you can find those stories when you type in Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into search engine. But we'll be back same time at 6 a.m. PNG tomorrow. And you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. As always, it's your news next. And coming up after that, it is Nita Daily. Until next time, o toa whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.